people still, and until the meeting is being continued. All right, welcome everybody to this session of workforce training and education from the HEP side and also from Accelerator side. Before we start the meeting, there are some core principles that we need to adhere to in terms of, you know, being the best people on Zoom. So I guess this is for your kind consideration. You know, so everybody follows some kind of being nice and not being interrupted. This is the code of conduct. All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit from when I say HEP side, I'm representing basically Community Engagement Frontier. And since we are paired up with Accelerator, I can say that I'm coming from the HEP side, though HEP cannot function without accelerators in most of the experiments. All right, so here I have basically a collage of pictures of who are engaged in the Community Engagement Frontier. We have many topical group conveners. The topics are highlighted in the red font here. And then we also are led by our conveners, Breeze and Ketevi. And most of these topical groups are engaged in HEP workforce career and training, if not directly, then indirectly. So, but the goal is that it's not just us, but the whole HEP community in the end should find itself responsible to be engaged in the work that we plan to do in coming months. So, as you know, the HEP ecosystem overlaps with many other fields. So, you know, instrumentation, for example, accelerator, computing, academia. The reason why I say overlap, for example, our HEP research, most of it is based on accelerators, but accelerators are used not only for HEP, but for other purposes also. So that kind of overlap is what I'm talking about. So most of the workforce that we are trying to prepare would not only help us is succeed in our HEP goals, but once, if they want to step outside HEP, then they should have enough skills to find jobs in what we call as industry or software companies and so on and so forth. So this is the workforce that we are talking about for us. And if they want to go outside the field, then they should have enough skill and help and mentoring to be able to do that. This pyramid, it looks very busy, but I guess you can have a better gaze later. But this is presenting a big picture of education and training that is needed to prepare the workforce at different levels. So we start at the very basic level of K-12 and where mostly it's the outreach. And then as we progress up, we give input from training on different frontiers, which could be software or you know, hardware, instrumentation, or you know, many other things. So that will help prepare this workforce by attacking it at different levels that are shown in this pyramid. The charge of different topical groups in CEF is enlisted here. I'm not going to go through all of them, for example, the career pipeline, it's not just making the young scientists aware of different opportunities, but also to make them or enable them to choose different career paths within or outside HEP. And then for education, you know, education is something that is very important at every level. It's even important for postdocs and younger faculties also. So we need to have a continuous system of educating them. It's not just acquiring a PhD degree. So here in this topical groups that are listed, many of them help within HEP and some of them like diversity, inclusion, public policy, and education outreach, they basically help us from bringing people from outside or affecting what we do, take them to outside our community. So we have inside and outside both covered in different topical groups. We received actually about 100 LOIs in this CEF, and we try to group them. And here are some of the groups listed in different colors so that it's not stressful to your eyes, but you can browse them. What are the different groupings that we have, and the goal in the next months would be that to make people who have submitted LOIs aware that what group their LOI belongs to, and then we start working on it and bring in more people also depending on if they wish to. So the discussion goals for this meeting and in coming weeks and months should be that what needs to occur between now and the next July meeting. We have to study different variety of topics and also focus on inter-frontier discussions, which have been lacking so far for a good reason, because everybody's busy with their own frontier and it's understandable. But now it would be time to step back and see what is the big picture of LOIs that are out there and people can contribute. And also provide space for members across the field to talk to each other, beginning with this kind of meeting that we have, and identify any gaps or further input that we need to achieve our SNOMAS goals. So I would really encourage people, if they, in this meeting, of course, we can talk, it's being recorded, but post meeting, you can, there's a Slack channel, please subscribe to it and put in your thoughts and we can discuss over there. So that is what I have. And I think next we will go to Steve for his presentation from the accelerator frontier. Any question now, or we should just proceed? Anyway, I will stop sharing and see if I am efficient again. One more time. Desktop, share, and I have to quit the false. Oh, wait a minute. So maybe I need to close this window, and I go here, and then if I share, then what happens? No, sorry.
I'm already seeing it. I think you're already sharing your desktop.
Yeah, but okay, so let's start, okay, if that's okay. Instead of full screen, we can just...
You can click view and then presentation mode, and that sidebar will go away, I believe, anyway.
So view and...
present at the top, at the very top.
Okay, so is it visible to everybody?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm Steve Lund, and I'm here with David Brewiler as part of the Accelerator Frontier and Topical Group 1, Beam Physics Accelerator Education, Outreach, and Diversity. And I have co-conveners Mei Bai and Zhurong Huang, who I saw are both here in the session, and they can chime in. But we collected about, I think, 60 to 70 LOIs that were organized into four tiers. And I won't bother to mention the other ones, but the fourth tier of this got lumped in this SNOMAS breakout session 119 with the community engagement frontier, because they're covering education, outreach, and diversity, but within the focus of the accelerator community. And generally speaking, I think we have a little bit different issues in the physics end of high energy physics and the accelerator physics end, but we can probably learn from each other on this. And so some of this could come to some good. I think particularly high energy physics has much better community outreach than we do, and we can perhaps learn some from this. Okay, next slide. Now, in our education, outreach, and diversity, we had eight LOIs that I'm not going to bother to read through, that are going to be summarized by people following me in brief presentations incorporated in the slide set. And this is also shared on Indico with the links and everything and the material, and people can take a look at it then. Okay, next one. Next slide. Outreach, we had five LOIs, and I'm including some double counting that have dual coverage, I should say, in this, and two diversity LOIs. And okay, next slide. And our next steps that we want to come out of this meeting is to have a follow-on SNOMAS workshop via Zoom on accelerator outreach, education, and diversity, which we've abbreviated to be EOD topics. I think it would probably be better to have that mid to late October at this point. And following this, we should see what comes out of this and send a poll for a convenient time with some proposed topics and organization of that. And hopefully what we learned today will help refine that agenda. The final goal I'd like to remind everyone is a consensus accelerator community recommendations for incorporation in our SNOMAS report. And we'll need that by July 2021. So we have some work ahead of us. Next slide. So today I asked the people highlighted in black here in two tiers to highlight workforce education and training, and also recruitment and retention in about a total of 13 minutes. This will be Bill Barletta covering training and education, and also John Fox covering recruitment and retention. After that, we'll switch over to outreach and diversity. May Bai will cover workforce and diversity roles. Frank Zimmerman couldn't join us, but he sent input that I'll go over on facility summaries. And likewise, David Breuweiler unfortunately had a conflict with outreach and industry, and I have input from him also, and we'll go over those. Next slide. Now we'll transition to Bill Barletta. Next slide after this, workforce. Okay, thanks, Bill.
Okay, so I've been asked to speak about five letters summarized. I'm going to summarize as challenges in educating the next generation. So first, let's ask why this is important. Show the first slide. I've noted the letters by their actual number. That somehow in the master, great master list. In the next slide, the first one is letter 37, which is, Steve, can you flip?
Sadir.
Yeah. Okay. Which talks about USPAS needs. And my comment is that this list of needs shows the casualty that remains from switching the structure of the USPES under the machinations of OHEP. Now, the statement claims that there are steady demands by the national labs and increased demands from industry that are not met, and that statement ignores engineers. In fact, all of the topics that we've seen so far ignore the fact that our second-class citizens, called engineers, are essential to the accomplishment of our programs. In fact, the response to this complaint is that university programs cannot grow without additional faculty lines, and that in turn requires more funding of foundational and transformational research that's unconnected to projects in national labs. And that means the DOE has to stop valuing what are you doing for project A or B, and value vibrant educational programs for intellectual independence rather than their traineeships for journeyman level gigs. As we go on, the claim need for 60 to, and maybe that's in the next, that's in the so-called grand challenges. The claim need for 60 to 80 new PhDs in accelerator physics is just not credible. Otherwise, we wouldn't see talented and experienced people laid off. That letter had a boilerplate message about diversity rather than any commitment from DOE and the labs to give their staff work time and professional credit for outreach. In fact, when you've already heard discussion, diversity, you know, the critical thing to me, you know, we all have our pet foci, is equity. And in fact, that's the big problem, especially as seen in the next letter, which was called Accelerate Early Career Scientists and Engineers. I thought this was the most valuable letter that I read. And there are several points that that these young people made. One, be open and honest about real workforce needs and funding realities rather than laboratory wish lists. They note right up front that opportunity to produce peer-reviewed publications is essential, but those opportunities are limited because the work critical to satisfying users at user facilities runs below the high standards of high impact journals. They also asked to expand the number of universities with accelerator education programs, and that could include, but they didn't specifically mention engineering. And, you know, as a person whose first degree is in engineering, I see that as a big miss. they asked for to be serious in, on the institutional level about commitment to work-life balance, to mentoring, and to making young people feel that they are in fact knowledgeable and important to the enterprise of the laboratory or university as a whole. They note that senior community people don't get proper reward for teaching, outreach, mentoring, and knowledge transfer. And my only criticism there is that that ought to be something that all staff, not just old timers like myself, get rewarded to. And that means having a salary structure and management structure that's equitable to all activities that benefit our community and our institutions. Next slide. The paper on workforce diversity, I have to say, I can never read something without putting on my hat as an editor. The writing was poor. I hate to say that native speakers of English should learn how to write English, but you know, physicists need good copy editors. You can't make serious points if the writing is poor. There are proposed actions, which you can see, which are collecting data and so forth, and then discuss more. I would claim that in order to do this, and this was referred to in the first letter from USPAS, in order to do the longitudinal studies of equity and diversity and outreach, one needs a level of effort and a broad discretion in using DOE funds that generally is not available, in fact, which is generally prohibited. And beside which, we've got to do this more than once every snowmass. We have to do this continually. And finally, there was the letter on the strategy for the HEP accelerated workforce training. It says that it's critical that to establish a nationally coordinated, synergistic education and training program of the workforce. However, DOE doesn't act that way, and our experimental and theoretical particle physics colleagues, I think, manage pretty well without having DOE tell them about how to coordinate a national educational program. That letter has a table of critical needs. When you write a table like this and you want to gain traction, you can't have serious multiple errors. I'll give you one. It says BES doesn't care about polarization of beams. Darn it. If you're part of a photon science laboratory, you know how wrong that statement is. Actually, what's needed is not DOE to tell us what the coordinated program is. We need three times more university physics and engineering departments that offer specialization. What's very hard in outreach is not to get physicists interested in our business, it's to get engineers interested in our business and to get the smart physicists to decide. And we've heard about this in a faculty meeting very recently. We want them to go into physics or engineering of accelerators and high-end particle physics, not decide they're going to work for Goldman Sachs. Yeah, we've had two recent graduates to go become a quant. I think, you know, Steve said discussion session will be very different because of the particle physicists being involved. I'd say that our particle physics colleagues would not accept our situation in silence. What's needed is radical reform, and DOE really has to be banged on extremely hard. And I hope that the particle physicists on P5 will do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Next, John Fox, and next slide, please.
So I hope we stick to the time.
Yeah, please be mindful of the times. We need to keep things very abbreviated for the discussion.
I will do my best to be brief. So we could actually go to the third slide because Bill did the second one already. So let me just quickly comment on what I see. And again, these are numbered by Steve's proposal numbers, but There were three, and if you think about it, they're related to this theme in two ways. There's one, which is the third point here about increasing the graduate student pipeline in accelerator physics, that addresses the issue in particularly graduate education in the United States, that students usually apply to a graduate program with a thesis area or a research area in mind. And they've often pre-selected what research group they'd like to work with. If undergraduates don't know that accelerator physics and accelerator technology, and this is true both for the engineering as well as the physics side, don't know that this is an option for them, they're never going to apply to those graduate programs. They're never going to be represented in the pipeline. And so what this proposal is about is to develop undergraduate level colloquia that would be high quality, that could be offered to undergraduate institutions in the US, some liberal arts institutions that produce small numbers of physics graduates, some larger institutions, but that are the institutions that are not well connected to the existing accelerator education program. And this would increase visibility to both students as well as faculty. And I think would be a way to get more potential students into those small number of accelerator physics and engineering programs in the US. The other two letters have to do with basically on the opposite end of the pipeline, postdoctoral and early career people. The top one was really a letter about what early career researchers needs. What do postdocs need to be successful? And this is actually somewhat related to the points Bill was just making, that they need to publish if they're going to have a professional career path. They need to create communities. They need to get funding for doing their own independent directed work. It doesn't have to be 100% of their activity, but they have to demonstrate they can do scientific leadership and lead research programs. And then the third letter really points out that Europe has a very different mechanism for supporting this transition from the young PhD to a postdoc to a potential university position or lab staff position. And there's European community funding that supports numerous fellowships, exchange, and training programs. And the letter asks, can the US participate or emulate these important programs for young scientists? So I'm going to comment one closing thought. All of these themes about encouraging young people and helping them be successful can only make sense if there really are research opportunities for PhDs in the field. And I will comment like Bill, in the current project-oriented environment, research opportunities are not present. And so it is difficult to imagine what you're going to do with these people coming through the pipeline. So with that, I will field or retire and let others continue the show.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. Next slide. Next, we're going to switch over to outreach and diversity, made by Frank Zimmerman and David Brewiler. So next slide, we'll transition to May by May.
Yes, Steve, and I will go quick. So this is a letter of interest of two actually combined, myself together with a number of colleagues listed here, as well as Petrao for on behalf of DPB. So next slide, please. I think a number of the reason behind it is already, I don't need to reiterate what Bill and John already said. There is a need, although there is various issues they pointed out. So what we did is because of IPAC 20, we did a survey from the IPAC European side. Worldwide, and what you see are the three charts of the women in science and engineer, because I was not able to obtain the full spectrum of diversity. And here you do see in the different continents, Europe, United States, and Asia, it's and the error bar goes, it's not the error bar, it's really variation from the number of samples. You do see the difference. You see the overall, the women still represented. And you see the mid-career and early career, and you see the pipeline issues. So Asia, for some reason, early career is even much, much less. During this survey, we came across a issue is the spread of the methodology of how to keep these statistics. So, and we were also surprised why after all decades of many efforts going on, we're still somehow stuck at about teens percentage ish. So next slide. So what we jointly propose is to the following actions. Say we would like to propose and discuss with you guys what would be a standard protocol to keep track of these statistics. I mean, if we don't know the situation, and you can also cherry pick situation from institute to institute. So this is only my personal experience. Most institutions are only doing the gender, particularly in Europe and in Asia, for the reason it is obvious. And also it is a very, very differently tracked, even for the gender side. Some of the institutions track in terms of the career, because I would like to, wanted to see the pipeline issue. I also wanted to see the physics side versus the engineering side, as Bill just pointed out, but it was very difficult to track that as well. So this is something would be, we would like to put out there, see whether we can improve the situation, that we know where we're targeting. And also we would like to engage you guys, why this is a probably Steve gave us a 3 minutes here to reach out to you. And also to engage the community to identify possible activities with measurable, effective measures, measurable outcomes. So there are, the first two are actually from DPB of our division, and enhanced outreach to primary schools. This is addressing the pipeline issue, and especially talking about under highly underrepresented areas. And taking that coherently with the third bullet, sub-bullet, you see, not only that, we would like to propose expanding to also, underrepresented colleges and universities along the same line. And also impact opportunities are dedicated, for instance, a scholarship to this group. The other, somebody just moved, I could not see the last tick. Yeah. And also explore alterations to career path to address, the difficulties for some talented people, but due to various private background that forbid them to go forward due to the financial difficulties. So I think also Bill and John also touched upon that in terms of salary. So this is the end of the letter of interest of our presentation. Can I have one more minute coming back to,
yes,
thank you, to what John and Bill mentioned about the networking, how Europeans are engaging the next generation. And I can confirm that is absolutely very aggressively and very effectively. There are numerous of opportunities for sure. They are also sitting geographically in the middle, particularly Germany is really in a very, very beneficiary situation. I want to mention to you, add the program to what John just mentioned, European-wise, German side, also we have the DAAD, the so-called DAAD. This is particularly addressing American PhD, undergraduate students or PhDs that you can contact me, we can bring you along. And then this will be founded jointly between US and also DPG of Germany. Sorry for not just an advertisement of that opportunity there. Thank you.
Thank you, May. Next slide. So these ones, the last two, I'm going to go through very quickly in a nutshell so we don't go too much over. But Frank Zimmerman submitted a very interesting LOI associated with community outreach on high-level facility summaries and articles promoting accelerator science. And the idea is to have publications regularly to serve as enhance the academic reputation of accelerator physics and serve as a reference for the community. Next slide. Now, this was already done. Physical Review Accelerators and Beams had a special edition with a special editor, Mike Blaskowitz, but they only really got one submission to that. And they would like to use the SNOMAS process to call attention to this and round up people to put out these facility summaries. And the idea is that this would serve these four purposes: to provide an up-to-date reference for the accelerator community and users, and to allow an easy way for people making use of the accelerators to give credit to the community. It would also help the accelerators journal's impact factor, like PRAB, and enhance the visibility of the community. Okay, next slide. And basically, they would like these articles to not just be limited to PRAB, but they really need participation of the community, but Physical Review X, Nature, Scientific American, and Physics Today. They really want to enhance the profile of the community. And I think it makes good sense, and SNOMAS is a logical place to revisit this issue and why it didn't work. And Frank put some references in here, next slide, that will be in the slide set. Okay, next slide. Then the final topic is accelerator outreach with industry. David Brewiler summarized two LOIs with that. HEP and industry partnership was an LOI submitted by Chen, and he was pointing out that many HEP personnel find their way into careers in industry in our field. And high energy physics touches on this a little bit, but accelerators is very much ingrained with this because we're producing products and things. And he makes the point that we should better organize this to facilitate the mobility of our young people. And I can tell you, running the US Particle Accelerator School, about a third of our students are now going off to industry. They're not just going into national labs like years ago. And so it's as well motivated to do a better job with this. David Brewiler touched on the collaboration between industry and the HEP community, largely focusing on software development. And this makes very good sense because the development needs of software are not very well done by the national labs. And we have a lot of codes that are being replicated and things and not effectively used. And he points out that companies can be integrated in this process and deal better with distributing the software and maintaining usability and core competencies, and how this would integrate with the career pipeline also needs to be addressed. Okay, and sorry, I think we're a little bit over the intended budget time, but that's, I guess, standard with these kind of things. Okay, how do we proceed from here, Sudhir?
I'll close this one. And next speaker is Julie Hoven, who will talk about specifically about career pipeline and development stuff. Julie, okay, so can you see my screen right now?
Yep, it seems fine. I think if you hit present, we'll be good.
Can you go to present mode? Okay, great.
Yeah, so this is, just to introduce one of the topical groups for the community engagement frontier, we're community engagement frontier number two, which is career pipeline and development. And so some of our just overview statements are that we want to identify and promote broad career opportunities that, you know, some are within high energy physics, many are without of high energy physics. We want to identify and promote skill development where we focus more intentionally on a variety of skills, including our technical hardware skills, let's say computational skills, programming skills, communication. How are we able to do outreach and present ourselves? And then, of course, basic career building skills like networking and things like that. We want to encourage our community here to plan careers more based on aptitude of people rather than, let's say, traditions. So the abilities of specific postdocs or students should inform where their career path goes rather than, let's say, a blanket encouragement towards research careers in academia. To do that, we need to encourage broader mentorship toward all of these career paths. It's difficult to mentor, toward a path that you haven't followed, but that's something that's needed. So what can we do to get supervisors in our community the resources they need to mentor students correctly toward a broad variety of career paths? And some of the partnerships were just mentioned. We're interested in trying to see how partnership programs or training programs could work to connect people between high energy physics and industry or just other kind of non-traditional academia careers so that we can come together more. We can boost everyone's productivity and the flow of people between these different industries. So we have a lot of synergy with other groups. As we've seen already today, we have a lot of synergy with other topical groups and, of course, other frontiers that we'll explore. So you can go to the next slide, sit here. This is kind of a table of our LOIs. We did receive a large number of LOIs, which is great to see people so engaged with these issues. The blue boxes are sort of representing the categories of LOIs that we feel are most centrally connected to our topical group. There are several LOIs on how we can enhance high energy physics research at non-R1 universities. So four-year colleges, even community colleges, how can we work on equalizing the playing field between those institutions and R1s or helping faculty that are already there do good research. On the right-hand side, the blue boxes, one of them, this is kind of interesting, thinking about brain drain. Why do people leave high energy physics and how could we help them to stay? And then, of course, facilitating connections with industry careers. We want people to be, excited and passionate about taking the knowledge they get from high energy physics into industry. And then maybe even building partnerships that let that go vice versa and inform high energy physics from the industry side. But then we have a lot of connections with other groups. So there are a lot of LOIs focused on diversity and inclusion in various fields, focused on education, physics education, and how we could expand our career opportunities through more education. Outreach to the public, there's some LOIs based on maybe even some computational things, machine learning, open science, and then of course, instrumentation, the application in industry, topical group and the accelerator and instrumentation frontiers. We have a couple LOIs that are synchronous with those groups. So this is really exciting and a lot of good ideas coming in. Next slide. We wanted to share some of the questions that we put for the panel that was earlier. These were our questions to the frontiers, to all the frontiers. The first one is, thinking about these other institutions, four-year institutions in particular, there's a variety of hurdles to working at one of these institutions compared to a research university. And so this is something we could think about as each frontier. How could we work on finding ways to mitigate these obstacles? And another one is perhaps more connected to what we've been talking about so far today. How can each frontier engage in common training? So training in software or hardware that is sort of generic across in skill building across high energy physics. Each experiment has its own challenges, but what can we do to make the training you get in one experiment more transferable across the others or across industry? And then finally, this is maybe one of our more practical ideas. we're very cognizant of the fact that many people leave the field. And so we need a way to streamline their process of finding a job. And we all know that it's who you know and it's who knows you when you're looking for a job. So how can we better connect high energy physics students and postdocs with people who formerly worked in this field or vice versa, following on some of the examples perhaps from CERN. So how can each one of the snowmass frontiers kind of connect with this idea and help implement such a plan? Okay. The last slide then is our set of next steps. So obviously before next July, we have a lot of work to do. Firstly, to organize these LOIs, there are some that will contribute to in a secondary way, some in a primary way, and we can organize the workforce here, build names and contributors. And we've already begun thinking of some survey questions that as an entire community engagement frontier, we might send the community a survey to collect some data. But we need to figure out what it actually takes to do this and how, you know, what input we need from the other frontiers, because a lot of these are cross working group ideas. So we hope that we're able to promote, you know, a space where everyone can kind of discuss and promote these new ideas, and we figure out together what we need to do to actually achieve our snowmass goals. Okay. And that is it.
Thank you. Thank you, Julie. All right. The next speaker is Randy Rupti from Notre Dame. Randy will talk about physics education aspect of community engagement frontier. My question is, can you see the PowerPoint slide?
Yep.
Okay, well, so let me go to the full screen mode and see what happens. Okay, please, Randy, go ahead.
Thanks, Sudhir. So I thought these introductory talks by the accelerator group were really great. I think they're helping to really give me an interesting shove. And so accelerators are the answer. I think this is kind of the column on the left, and research and accelerator of science and technology is important. I think we kind of hear this, and that's a driver to get many researchers into the field. And in addition, it's fundamental to the research that many of us do who are practitioners in particle physics, nuclear physics, and other areas. And there are obviously connections to medicine and treatment, and there are also huge industrial applications of these things. So those are all very large drivers. So from my side, I would say this just really sounds great. So we have some questions on how education, in particular physics education, gets into this. And you'll see some of the challenges we have. But I have a list of a few questions here that are partially already addressed earlier, but are important here. So do we have a shortage of expertise in the accelerator field to address these issues? And I'm hearing there is, but the question is, how do you tackle that? And what are the location of the facilities where accelerators are operated and built and structured? So national, regional, and local access is an issue. And what kind of training is needed for each? Is it really a PhD? Is really a good master's what you need, or a technical school? I'm hearing multiple answers to that. I think they're all very positive, but the idea is to crystallize the arguments. And how many persons would be needed over the next two decades? I heard from May and others, Bill, in your talk, you were saying, you know, that the number of people are needed is far less than what is actually required. I think the idea would be not to just have a blanket number, but how it would need to grow if the country is to be successful, if the fields are to be successful, if we're to be competitive in science and also technically in our country. And then where should the training occur? Labs is an obvious one, or universities is another one in industry, but how do those get coordinated? And then training instructors and teachers that will actually get students who are in the chain up there, and is there an availability of resource materials at a variety of levels to help foster that? And then what are the techniques so we reach a broad spectrum of students? Because those near large national laboratories or universities that have a history in accelerator work obviously have a clear edge. How do we get others there? Next slide. So this shows us, Sudhir showed this initially. This is a pyramid that he created, and I think it shows the scale of the problem. There's a very large number of students at the bottom, and feels like particle physics, and in academia, the number of faculty at the top is very few. So the probability someone in the green box at the bottom gets to the top in the yellow is not a very hard, large probability. So how do you get interested people up there, but how do you engage many more people to get up a good way through this process, for example, to a master's degree, to other areas that would take them not only to academia, but also into industry? This is the challenge. And when we first started with our physics education group, we were thinking that we were going to be tackling sort of that middle ground, undergrad, graduate, and postdocs. And in fact, we inherited now, without too much of a surprise, K-12 all the way up. And education has to occur at all of these levels. And the secret is to build energy into the system and how we can together deliver on that kind of set of ideas. Next slide. So our topical group got a very large number of LOIs, 29, and they've sort of been loosely aggregated into five groups. One is career in education, which fits in what we've already heard. General education, K-12 and up, particle physics specific education, there are a number of those, public education, and then global software issues like open data and other things like that, and they've kind of fallen into this group, but they are really shareable and really broad topics. The thing that's interesting is if this was probably an older time, almost all of the focus would have been on particle physics education and career in education. But I'm very pleased to say that we have a number of LOIs that target into K-12. This is good because this means there's an interest in the community to get people at a young age, young children in school, up through the process and help strengthen this more broadly. This is great news. The question is, how do we build and strengthen that in building white papers as part of the SNOMAS process? Next slide. So this is, I think, a very nice geographic analogy here. We can see our SNOMAS location of the meeting next summer if the medical situation in the world allows it, in Seattle. But the Columbia River ecosystem is very nearby and includes the Columbia River and then the Snake Rivers, you can see. And there are all these dams there that allow the water to be managed. And then you see this big split in there. Every one of these hurdles can be equated to an educational hurdle that students have to get over going up through the chain. And maybe it's in that lower right that it's somebody's faculty idea of success, and everybody else in the middle never gets over those intermediate dams. And it's a very rich structure. So this analogy says there's work to do to take that pyramid and instead of make it pointed at the top, to spread it out much larger and more embracing of a stronger research community that would include PhDs, yes, but it would include master's people, and that there wouldn't be this hierarchical preference for only one endpoint compared to others. I think this is a weakness of our field, and I think it would be important to try to correct that. And we've got 20 years to work on it. Next slide, please. So following this one for people to review are the number of LOIs we got and how they were grouped, and you could have a look at those. But I'm back to our set of seven questions, which I think are the ones that would be important among others to focus on. And I look forward actually to the discussions. The accelerator people have said that they're planning a workshop. I think this is an area that CF4 and CEF2 would be very pleased to be engaged in later in the month. Thank you.
Thanks, Randy. Thank you very much for nice slides. So the, let's see if I can get out of this mode. Why is it?
Try clicking escape, Sudhir.
Yeah, I'm saying ending the show. Okay. So, all right. So next, Next speaker is, you can see the slides?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so next speaker is Vetri Whelan. He's a young, energetic, early career person from Berkeley. So he'll present the early career perspective. Yes, Vetri, please go ahead.
Yeah, hey, everyone. So I kind of wanted to provide the perspective of myself and several other early career physicists in this space. So I want to first begin by thanking, I'm not going to name because I'm going to forget people, but thanking other people who have contributed to this this effort from the early career side. So to start with, on the left, I just have a few bullet items about what's been done so far, meaning like what have early career scientists contributed in the HEP Accelerator workforce careers and training space. So I've counted at least 130 LOIs submitted or spearheaded by early career members to the Career Pipeline and Development and Physics Education topical groups. That's at least because I just did the best I could to count. And also that's out of about 150 LOIs that have been submitted by early career members to SNOMAS overall. Some of the topics that have been included are like particle physics education at the undergraduate and graduate levels, research opportunities for students at community colleges, the breadth of career training. So this is kind of building off of what was just being talked about this, you know, the skills that you gain in a PhD being applicable to a lot of different jobs, training in specific things like instrumentation and software and machine learning, equity issues in the career pipeline. We've heard a lot about that today. Physics in high school training, giving students training on things like teaching and mentorship, not just research. So there have also been a lot of involvement by early career physicists in various topical group meetings. And of course, like, you know, early career, I'm trying to give the perspective on like the community engagement and workforce perspective. But of course, early career physicists have been involved in like all the normal SNOMAS processes as well. So, you know, cosmic frontier, neutrino frontier, energy frontier, et cetera. And I'll also point out that there are some formal liaisons between SNOMAS, early career, and the different frontiers and topical groups. And so I also just want to give them a shout out for doing a lot of work for getting people engaged. But this is kind of what's been done, you know, so far. And then for the future, you know, I talked to some folks and looked into like, what are people excited for over the next year? And pretty much the answer was that, you know, early career physicists are excited to engage in all of the SNOMAS process, just as everyone else is, particularly regarding white paper writing. Pretty much everything that was an LOI, so like everything that I wrote on the left-hand side, people are interested in turning into white papers. So that's great. And then of course, there are plans to stay involved in the research frontiers, of course. If you can move to the next slide, Sudhir. So then I just have some discussion questions that, you know, can guide the discussion that we're gonna have that people brought up and that I thought of. So, you know, what are the expectations and desires to have grad students and postdocs and other early career folks involved in white paper writing? And building off of that, actually, kind of as an addendum to that question, you know, what's the incentive for grad students, postdocs to be involved in SNOMAS? I've heard a lot of people saying that, you know, we're not getting like paid to do this. And it's not obvious that there are career incentives, especially for something like the community engagement frontier. So like, how do we make sure that early career folks are engaged? Because of course, like we're the ones that are gonna be dealing with these issues for the rest of our career. You know, like how can we consolidate our efforts into a smaller subset of white papers within the community engagement frontier? And like, you know, one thing that that I heard was like, and that I'd be interested in hearing from other people is like, if you submitted an LOI, like what did you expect to happen after that? And like, what has happened since then? And is there some way that related LOIs can find each other? Like, are we just supposed to wait for the conveners? Is there other avenues that we're supposed to be taking? And on that note, you know, what are the avenues to advertise for collaborators in terms of like white paper collaborators, I should be more specific, white paper collaborators at or after CPM? So these are just some questions that I thought could guide the discussion.
Okay, thank you, Petri, for this short presentation, but succinct. All right, I think that's the end of the presentation part, and now we can do some discussion how to go from here, next steps, you know, basically. So let me stop sharing, or maybe I can go to the set of things that are here. Steve, I want to give you a first chance. Like, what does Accelerator Front sees in common with us, you know? And so yeah. how do we chalk that out? Or I don't think the idea is not to stay aloof, the idea is to gel from this point onwards, yeah.
Well, you know, I was thinking during the presentations, we have a little bit of a different situation, and we can probably learn from each other. In the Accelerator community, Bill made the point, it may not be as rosy as it's made out to be, but generally speaking, our students can find jobs in field. And the situation is they have a hard time having academic careers, which you guys do a lot better with. And there needs to be money for the faculty to carry out research and publish and things and more for more academic profile. But we also have a tremendous problem recruiting students. In spite of the difficulty of finding work in most subfields of physics, I can tell you as a rare faculty member at a university sitting on the committees admitting students, the students have to be convinced very hard to come in our field that there's interesting and rich physics within that and to be sold on it. They almost look at it as a step down or something like that. And it can be very frustrating. So a lot of times we're looking for people that have flunked out of other areas, which isn't a good basis to kind of build on. And you guys have really tremendous talent in high energy physics. And some of your people move over to accelerators and have had tremendous careers doing that. Maybe some dialogue to come out of Snowmass in how we could get appropriate people in and placed, and also how to promote our faculty a little better and academic profile could all make sense to come out of this process.
Yes, thanks. Anyone who wants to follow up what Steve said? I think this is also a general problem, right? Yeah. It's a general issue also, but I guess, anyone who wants to follow up on Steve, any suggestion?
I just want to echo, this is May, Steve's point. I think the accelerator faculty is a rather new thing with respect to high energy physics faculty. And this may have been part of the reason that it is not widely yet attractive. And not only that, almost every university in the States or the worldwide has high energy physics branch, but very rare to find a university has dedicated faculty, let alone two. Typically, I would say more than one in university. I mean, Rich yesterday from Cornell, she showed a roadmap. It was a very nice slide. She showed it was like 12 university of entire United States, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difficulty. And then you combine them, so yeah.
Bill, by the way, touched on this a little, Bill Barletta, that there needs to be credit for academic production and things in the laboratory, in the national labs also. For example, I have a faculty position and I'm also directing the US Particle Accelerator School. And I have to do a lot of this kind of stuff as a part-time job, including all my teaching roles for accelerators. It doesn't count literally in within the laboratory structure. And I'm not unique to that. One of my common jokes in our accelerator school is to tell everyone, oh yes, the professors, they donated, they all had a lot of time from their day jobs granted to formulate this class that you're in. And it always draws chuckles because nobody gets that dispensation in our field. And maybe that's true to some degree in high energy physics also, but I believe we're a step or two worse in that. And it really does have repercussions in our field. And I don't know how to fix it either.
So I can add a little bit perspective from HEP side. You know, in HEP, you know, the prime goal is to have be good in to produce publication, to do an ad physics analysis, but the field is so huge that people are, some people are 100% involved in keeping up the detector or involved in computing and do not have time to devote to analysis. So now the thing is, when such people want jobs at universities, then the first thing is what physics you have done. So I guess, I know one instance where a job at a university was created, especially with a hardware person in mind. So in that way, you could be hired, you know. So similarly, an accelerator person, but as I said, very few universities have these kind of jobs. But I think one, it's important to create jobs especially targeted to accommodate these people who are very valuable to run the experiment itself, right? So, yeah. Okay, I would say that many of our presenters had some questions in their slides. And I think we, since both Accelerator and HEP communities are here, maybe it's worth discussing those. Sudhir,
I have my hand up. Do you mind if I make a comment?
Absolutely. I apologize. You know, nobody.
Sorry. My name is Kathy Harkey. I was on Mei Bai's LOI. I just thought of something as Mei was, as people were talking and Steve were talking, that in accelerator field, accelerator faculty is relatively new. I also thought that a lot of the textbooks, the availability of textbooks, when I got my PhD in accelerator physics, there were no textbooks at all. I learned from the accelerator schools. Since then, I think many of the instructors at the accelerator schools have used that material to make textbooks. And I think this is a wonderful, wonderful thing. What I'm thinking is on the engineering side, I don't know what the status of textbooks is for training engineers in the specific areas that we need for accelerator technology. So I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know if anyone has any comments. That's all.
Yes, I guess that's thanks, Kathy, for bringing that question. I think this is precisely what Randy has in his slides, that how do we educate those who are within the field, you know, or are like upcoming in the field, how do we educate them? And so I think that's very important. Now, besides the school, you know, there could be books, good books, you know, and that is very important. To engage scientists or people in the field to actually write books that are relevant and educative in nature. So Randy, do you have any, Kathy, okay, this Kathy, can you please put your hand down if you don't have another question?
By the way, Daniel Winkelner in the chat has said, basically, yes. He believes that if there were experiments in the university dedicated to academics and funding for that, that all the things like faculty positions and whatnot would follow. And so, and we have had issues with the funding going down a lot in accelerators in spite of the labs being healthy with big projects and things, the academic funding is not there. So it may really be a valid point. And this is the type of thing Snowmass and P5 could really have an impact with. And remember, accelerators also serves more than high energy physics. Historically, we were centered in high energy physics, but now, you know, nuclear physics, light sources and other things have maybe contributing more to future high energy physics machines than vice versa at this point. So our field is a little bit more broad than just high energy physics centered machines, or quite a bit more, I should say.
I want to raise, can I raise my hand?
Okay. Yes, please.
Okay, I want to follow up Kathy's point on the engineering, which Bill also pointed out. For accelerator, as Steve pointed out, the many differences, one of the difference, major difference, maybe not at the engineering and technician. We need engineers. The diversity side, if the physics side is already dwindling to the teens, go to the engineering side. I always challenge people to find me a female high power RF engineer. So that part I also observation, don't have a good answer. Cassie has the way, good way to point it out, that how to educate them. I'm not, yeah, maybe it's, one of you guys can keep this into the question into the upcoming month discussions.
Okay, thanks, May. John, yes, please go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to say in response to May, I know a few high-powered RF engineers who are female in Europe. I don't
only
know
what, a few, John.
Yeah, a few, still some very good ones. We did send a letter of interest from the JUAS school in Europe, the Joint Universities Accelerator School, which provides fundamental accelerator physics and technology courses to students as part of master's and PhD degrees in 16 different universities in Europe. That's one model for integrating the subject better into university curricula. Okay, that's all I wanted to say.
So I guess this is one aspect of, you know, keeping the flow of workforce to related HEP related field, right? And of course, please keep in mind there's a whole lot of other things in the sense that if people move out, of HEP totally, then they have to be guided as well. So anyway, before we move to that, any questions directly related with the accelerator thing?
Yeah, let me comment one thing about the engineering. High power RF, the number of universities, engineering departments that teach RF topics is becoming, you probably can count them on your hand. High power RF, there are almost no places. They're just very few. Same thing is true to people that can design modulators or other high power electronics for accelerators. So that's a problem. Regarding the outreach, I ask anybody, when's the last time you remember an exciting NOVA program about accelerators? Where's the program that has Gen 11 talking about an accelerator topic? I've all looked for many YouTube videos about accelerators. Young people look at these. There are a few good ones, but most of them is just shameless advertisements for a lab. We could do a lot better. And, you know, the kids, high school students are not going to read a paper. Make a good YouTube video. Get somebody to give a TED, you know, how many TED Talks have there been about accelerators? We have to think about the media that actually reach out to students. And in particular, as I say, you know, engineering is tough. It's tough to recruit engineers into our business. And yet, at least in the accelerators we build aren't simple. They're not easy. They're a great accelerator. They're great engineering challenges. Well, that should be an easy sell if we actually understood how to do it.
This is Emanuela Barzi, if I may intervene on this topic.
Please, Emanuela.
So we submitted an LOI on training in the US of Italian science students. And I'm not sure why I didn't see it in this presentation, because we submitted it to both the F4 topical group of and AF1. But anyway, We have a very successful program of graduate students from Italy at Fermilab that was also extended as a pilot to Brookhaven. So we get a dozen of physics graduate students and a dozen of engineering graduate students a year. We distribute them over a majority of Fermilab's divisions. And I'm not as familiar as the engineering education in the US, but I can tell you that in Europe, or at the very least in Italy, engineers are scientists. They're educated as, you know, they're very high level educated. So when they come for these internships, summer internships at Fermilab over just 2 months, 9 weeks, they get immediately integrated into their research group and they leave a mark, because as it was discussed in this group, there is a very large need of engineering capabilities. And these graduate students from Europe, even if only on the short term, but over those 2 months, they really contribute and they leave a mark. And they allow research groups at Fermilab sometimes to achieve results or do analysis that otherwise they wouldn't have had the time or the capabilities to do it. So, and a majority of these students, of these engineering students, want to come back and make and attend a PhD in America. So yes, on one hand, I understand that we need more accelerator education in US academia. On the other hand, a well-educated engineer, especially in the mechanical, when they are mostly on the mechanical end of the spectrum, they can do a lot in accelerators. And so also invoking what Bill Barletta indicated in his presentation, what I would like to propose in our white paper is to expand this European program to a majority of the US accelerator labs. So my dream is to see these very talented people come and learn and contribute to the American accelerator field, and possibly some of them will come back and keep contributing. And this, I'm sure, should fit very well into any new initiative in creating new college university educations in accelerator, because these young people then can also contribute in that area, in that respect.
Okay. Thanks, Manuela. That was good. I think one quick suggestion or idea that I have is, you know, when in HEP we do a lot of outreach for HEP as a whole. You know, we talk about nice physics, Higgs, this, that, Nobel Prizes. I think it would be nice if we could, and there's a very well-established QuarkNet program for that, but we also talk about accelerators, but just as a, you know, glamorous thing. But if we could incorporate a bit of more of accelerators in there, a bit of computing also there in a fraction of that. I think one kind of outreach program of QuarkNet can send message at least to the very lower level at K-12 kind. Of course, we need specific education, but at least it can excite people to this field and what are the different options right in the beginning. So, okay, thank you. So I think I would like to devote the next few minutes for regarding the physics education question, which also will be useful to accelerator from Randy. Randy, you have a list of questions. Do you think we can sort them out into one or two questions that you would like to talk in detail? If Randy is...
Yeah, I'm here. Yes, dear. I'm reacting to the discussion a little bit, and I would like to raise one point because I think May raised it. It may be Bill and others, so I want to make sure that I give the right credit, having heard this. But one of the features that we have in the physics education is also, and also in the career, are models of faculty interaction at the higher level. So this is at the level of postdocs and faculty and laboratory and technical expertise at that level. Given that the likelihood of finding an accelerator faculty member at a school is a very isolating exercise, I think we've heard that. Is there an aggregation methodology? I know there are joint appointments between, let's say, Fermilab or Brookhaven people, others with nearby universities, but are there models that might be suggested or joint appointments with industry at levels that would be at master's or PhD to just get that discussed a little bit that would strengthen the possible career opportunities and also strengthen departments into getting their interest in establishing accelerator research as an intrinsic part of their department?
No, I think it makes good sense. It could really help. There are some, and with our field, there's a lot of back and forth with industry, and particularly with engineering departments, it could especially resonate. I think physics is a little bit harder sell. You have to convince people that there is rich physics in it. And we've been hearing people expound on the interest of the engineering, but I would maintain the physics is equally interesting and creative in that. And we just have to do a better job as a field selling that. And we can certainly learn from the physics end of high energy physics with how to do that better.
Yeah, I mean, to be very frank, you know, when you work on an HEP experiment and you are a user of accelerator, what do people think who's working in the accelerator complex? You know, they think it's the physicists who decided to work on accelerators. You know, so they don't, most of us are not aware of what are the qualifications to become an accelerator physicist. You know, what all is needed? Is particle physics an essential part of it? Or, you know, what is dominating engineering skills, electronics, or, you know, so that I think is not very well known till you apply for a job as an accelerator physicist.
Yeah, it's, let's say, like in dynamics on the higher end, which is used in accelerators, you have the full formalism of Lie algebra, spin dynamics and everything, and it's very rich physics and a lot of creative manipulations and the machines really work and everything. And there's a compelling story in a lot of these and a lot of unsolved mysteries that you don't have to scrape very deeply to hit, particularly in collective interactions. And they make real differences for the futures of these facilities. But we do not sell them well. And I see this over and over again in my role at MSU as a faculty, seeing the incoming students come in.
Sorry, I don't want to take the whole time. But I think one thing is that the tentacles of HEP are far spread compared to accelerators.
Yeah.
So that can be changed. There are many questions. Yes, please.
I just want to add to Randy's. I want to also give a little bit of positive signature is the test facilities. That the situation is slightly better now because there are centers, CBB, there's various centers, not many, a few. This definitely helps. And the test facility yesterday was a dedicated session of our group on the test facilities. And this could also help that to allow these test facilities to have a research freedom to do basic research, curiosity driven, not just a project driven, that probably something to throw in here, find a cross link.
Right. Thanks, Mi. So I think that one thing is clear that both of our groups need to engage, you know, in coming months because there are a lot of ideas and we should probably try to inform each other of any big meetings that we plan to have achieving the, you know, goals in LOIs or even covering any gaps that we are talking about right now. I hope they're covered in LOIs. I haven't read all the LOIs, but not to leave any anything left behind. You know, that's the thing.
You know, this exercise has convinced me to be much more proactive in our next step organizations with the community engagement frontier to reach out and try to get some key involvement in our discussions of education and diversity topics. I do think there is a significant amount of commonality in what we can learn from each other in this.
Okay. Thank you. You know, we have a hard deadline of 2:30 central. But I think the next 10 minutes, I really want to give to talk about, you know, what Julie was mentioning about, you know, faculty positions at four-year colleges and also people going to industry. And I think I want to talk a little bit about that also. One idea that came to my mind was that, of course, besides what Julie was saying, mentoring and other things, you know, there were some people connected yesterday in Bree's session. I'm forgetting the name. So there are many such people who are in the same boat in the sense that they are not at R1 institutes. And I think they should form like their own community to help each other. I think Julie has set a very good example. So Julie, do you want to talk a little bit about that and your questions that you have? I might try to bring them up if just give me a chance.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not a question that anyone, you know, here in the meeting has the authority to give the answer on, but just as a prod, you know, as we all have the ability to influence our experiments and our communities. You know, it's a fact that the more that one of the comments I liked, it said deromanticize the R1 and more romanticize other things. Everyone, you know, grabs different types of students. And so I think it's not a hard sell to say that we're bound to do better on some of these metrics that we're all attached to, like diversity and inclusion and things, if we embrace other modes of education and pull them into the research community more. But in order to make that happen, we have to find a way as experiments or as high energy physics to deal with some of the obstacles, like how we structure things such that people with different requirements on them from their different types of education can participate, you know, in a meaningful way, which would benefit everyone.
Anybody who wants to comment on this or add to this?
Can I make one? Yeah, I can make a comment. Is that the R1s have been in the spearhead of driving the publishing industry to gold open access. And the fact of the matter is that $3,000 of article processing charges doesn't fit well with the support that people in the so-called lower tier universities and colleges get. So we've got to if this is an APS exercise, the APS really needs to figure out how, and it's, you know, it's been those colleges that supported the subscription model, not the writers, it was the readers. And so somehow APS is going to figure out a way to give back. And if we don't do that and make life even harder for people in those colleges to do research work that they can afford to publish, mm-hmm. it will continue to look unattractive.
Yeah. So but I think it's good that, you know, this probably predominantly undergrad institutes, you know, our community is growing in them, and it's good that we address their hurdles or challenges because that is big part of growing our community. You know, community grows around R1 and not just R1, but everywhere. You know, so.
And it's interesting, I was thinking while we were discussing that actually the small size can have a hidden benefit, because for instance, at my university, it's not just the Department of Physics. We don't have a separate engineering school because it's not large enough. And so for us, the idea of saying, you know, well, let's get students who are interested in mechanical engineering to do some accelerator research with a particle physics faculty member at Fermilab over the summer is a thing. And so that might be something to encourage as well in other similar schools.
Cindy, you have your hand up. Yes, Cindy, please go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the comment. For one thing, I'm really appreciating this conversation. This is really enjoyable and thought-provoking, and a lot of things that have been said, I'm personally finding really validating. Another part is I wanted to mention. I think some people were in this or know about this, but yesterday there was a session 118 on cross-community mobility in science, and we sort of talked about. It was very similar to what was said here with the pyramid, where it's difficult for people to, you know, it's difficult for an engineer to move into a scientist position or vice versa, or you know, it's difficult for people to move around based upon the sort of path that they're on. And yet there's a great need for collaboration and for recognition of different types of contributions and things like that. So I just wanted to mention that as another possibility, perhaps for some sort of interplay, or that people who are interested in these conversations may be interested in those conversations as well. I think we had our own Slack channel as well for that one. Yes, we did. I think a lot of people know, again, that we're in that one know about this one and vice versa, but I wanted to mention it for anybody who hasn't seen it.
Yeah.
Well, by the way, one additional thing that we may have common interest in is APS does statistics overall of diversity in the field. However, when running the US Particle Accelerator School and directing role, I was trying to give summaries of how well we're doing in early career in the change. And I found the statistics somewhat lacking to be able to measure this, particularly in subfields like accelerators. And I would second what May's saying, that some contribution from this group on recommendations on how to track things and get some inertia going could be kind of helpful to see what the situation is, particularly with underrepresented minorities. It's really very difficult to see what the situation is right now.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Dave. We have just 3 minutes left, and Garvita, you've raised your hand. Please go ahead. So we have a hard deadline, so we need to wrap it up to respect the time. Go ahead, Garvita.
I just wanted to mention, so I really like the conversation that's going on, and it's very useful in a lot of questions that have come up with regards to the accelerator frontier. So I would want to take it towards the survey perspective of that. So the SNOMAS early career survey team is trying to put together questions that are relevant to different frontiers that are involved in the process. So we will be showing the slides tomorrow, and there would be a link. I'll also share it in the chat, but we would really appreciate it if some of these questions that you think might, you really would want to see the entire SNOMAS community answer. So we would be really glad to put them in the survey to get you those data points that you're looking for. So I just thought I would mention it here.
Yes. Thanks, Garvita, for bringing that to the attention. I just, in the couple of minutes left, I just want to address, if someone can address Vetri's question, which I think is like, what is the incentive for grad students to be involved in SNOMAS? He says, obviously, there are career incentives, but I guess it's more than that. What I feel is that it builds the nature of thinking beyond your own work when you participate in SNOMAS and things like that. You know, you think of serving your community to give it back, you know, besides, you know, thinking of careers. That's a process that starts early on. So you're aware of this, that you might be affected if you don't participate in this process early on in your career. I think that's one good motivation. So Vitri, do you have any quick question?
No, I think that's fine. We can talk about it on Slack, yes. Maybe if people have thoughts.
So in the last slide of my presentation, there's a Slack channel. And if you could join that would be wonderful. And I think the conversation actually begins today. It doesn't end today. So I would really look forward to informing each other about different career workforce things that are happening, you know. And of course, we will be in touch as we organize things, you know. Now we have more focus to follow in terms of LOIs. I really appreciate everybody for joining. It's really wonderful that we got so much attention and vice versa. And we'll see you in the rest of the SNOMAS program. Steve, do you have anything to add?
No, I think obviously the time is very limited here, and we have to really think now about the next steps and get people involved and schedule accordingly and make sure everyone's voice is heard.
Yes, thank you. So thank you, everybody, for joining.
Thank you, Sudhir. Thanks, Steve.
Yes, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, see you guys.
Bye.